Welcome to Tech Tuesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. Last fall, a robot named Terra Sentia toddled between rows of corn stalks, gathering information to generate a detailed portrait for the farmers testing the technology. Some farmers view robotic aids with skepticism. Others see them as an essential tool to grow crops that can weather climate extremes. New York Times reporter Kaval Sheikh has been covering the issue. Welcome to the show.
Hi, Anne. Thanks for having me.
What does the robot look like?
Well, it kind of resembles a slightly larger version of a robot vacuum that you would see in homes or a robotic lawnmower. It has these all-terrain wheels on it and cameras on each side. But the robot itself is still pretty small. It's about 30 pounds and a foot wide, just the right size that it can fit in between rows of crops.
And what kind of data is it collecting?
Well, it can collect all sorts of data about plant health and plant height, for example. Because the robot uses a laser beam as well as video cameras, it can collect information about how wide a stem is, how tall a plant is, what the color of the leaves is like. And those pieces of information tell the farmer basically how healthy their crops are and how many grains, how many ears of corn they're going to have by the end of the season, things like that.
What can the robot do that humans can't? I mean, can't just humans walk the rows and check out the plants? Isn't that what they used to do?
Well, actually, a lot of farmers still do that. They hire college interns sometimes and high school interns to do that work because it requires a lot of time-consuming work. You still have to go out into the field, take a ruler, and spend the whole day basically crawling through the rows, measuring the stalks by yourself. And there's still some guesswork involved because you can't really see the top of a corn stalk, for example. And you would have to also measure different ones that are standing next to each other. So it's kind of like you would be estimating if you do this yourself. Whereas the robot is doing it more, it has a lot more data. It's doing this a lot faster. So it's taking out the guesswork.
You're listening to Tech Tuesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. I'm talking with science reporter for the New York Times, Kaval Sheikh, about robots being used in farming. They observe the plants and they collect data for the farmers. If you have a question or comment for us, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or you can email us at allsides@wosu.org. We checked with the Ohio Farm Bureau, and the spokesman said that he doesn't know of any robots like this in Ohio, but he's seen the robots at trade shows. What do we know about how many are out there doing this, or is it just still experimental?
Well, this company in particular that produces the Terra Sentia is still pretty young. So they're hoping to have about 100 of these robots out this summer. And they're not any in Ohio yet, but from what I understand, they are talking to researchers at Ohio State University who might partner and use the robot for their work, as well as private agronomists. But the robot itself is used all over the U.S. They have a couple partners in Chile, from what I understand. And they might be expanding later on into Europe as well. And there are, of course, other companies that also produce similar robots that do some phenotyping work, which is measuring all of these plant traits. And there are others that do different kinds of robotic work, which would be like weeding or spraying fertilizer. But I would say that there are different categories of robots on farms now. So this particular one that measures all of the traits of plants and provides these detailed photograph to farmers is still pretty new.
What are we learning about how this detailed, photograph of the plants is helping farmers?
Well, right now it's mainly helping plant breeders, so it won't be directly useful for everyday farmers just yet. So plant breeders are using this technology to essentially speed up how they're crossing crops and making new varieties. Right now, breeding is very much a reactionary process. You have a lot of different genetic varieties and you cross them, you wait throughout the season, you measure how they're growing, and by the end of the season, you see which ones are the best plants. For example, which corn is producing the healthiest ears, which is the tallest, and things like that. And you will use the best crops and cross them. And that whole process takes about 8 or 10 years to get the next best variety that farmers can plant that will be more hardy, will have higher yields. And this robot will help breeders get that process done in about half that time.
Why is that? How can it do that?
So the way the robot does that is it gathers just so many data points that and it gathers them throughout the season rather than having to wait for a human to do it
Okay.
maybe once or twice in the growing season. This robot can do it whenever you need to get data. And by having all of those points, you can track how well a corn plant is doing and have information about which one will be the best plant by the end of the season, actually pretty early on. So it's kind of predictive, and that helps breeders do those crosses earlier, even before some of the plants flower.
And can it keep track of plants so that it all those data points, it's going down a row of corn, it's keeping track of each plant?
Right, yeah.
So it can go
So,
during a flood stage, see how it's doing then, go through a drought stage, see how it's doing then.
exactly.
Okay.
So the robot can also have a GPS in some cases, or it can its software can have a map of your field. So every time it goes through the same row, it will know which plants it was keeping track of, and whether those plants survived a heavy rainfall or whether they got damaged, it will keep track of all of that.
You wrote that this is 90s technology being used. How so?
Well, it's basically technology that was developed by computer scientists in the 90s. All of those computer chips and camera hardware that has been developed in the 90s helped become the technology become sophisticated and mature enough that it became miniaturized. So the technology that enabled our smartphones to have fancy cameras is the same technology that allows scientists to put those devices in a robot.
So it has a camera on it?
Yeah, it has four cameras
Oh.
actually, one on each side.
And so it's just taking pictures along the way. It's using laser beams to measure height and that sort of thing and width.
Yep. So each of the cameras takes a video as it moves. It's a pretty leisurely pace, about 1 mile an hour. And the laser beam keeps shooting out lasers that bounce off of the plants. And it works kind of like radar technology. When the laser beam bounces back, the sensors can tell what the width of a plant was or what the height was.
Is it being downloaded automatically, or does the farmer or the researcher need to do that and take it off the field from time to time to download or upload,
the
I should say?
The robot itself has a computer inside of it that can process some of the data, but it's not, the farmer can't really analyze it real time yet.
Okay.
So at the end of the day, they still have to take the robot home, plug it into their internet, and upload the data so that it can be analyzed.
Tell me, how much do these cost? I mean, are they affordable yet?
Well, the cost, from what I understand, varies because right now it's still in developmental stages. The cost is.
Hello? Are you there?
An academic researcher or a big private farmer. And the cost essentially is right now for the data analysis, mm-hmm. not actually so much for the hardware.
It's that, again, you compared it to like a robot vacuum cleaner at this point with cameras and laser beams on it.
Mm-hmm.
Have you seen one in action?
Yeah, I did. I visited a farm in Urbana, Illinois, which was using the robot, and the farmers were pretty excited.
Yeah, and you said about a mile an hour, so it just, I visualized sort of something toddling along. But what happens to it if there is a big flood or a rain or snow or whatever? I don't know. How does it handle the elements?
Well, the early versions of the robot did not handle the elements really well. So the researchers that developed the TerraSentia at EarthSense were telling me that they had to install shocks in the wheels just so that it could go over ruts in the field, if there was debris lying around. And you still have to have somebody walking a couple paces behind the robot just in case it runs into something or it trips over.
Okay.
And you need to right its course. But eventually they expect to have it completely self-sufficient and automated so that you could just sit back and relax while it's doing its work.
Farmers are sure they're saying, yeah, that's what I'm doing. I'm sitting back and relaxing. But Kaval Sheikh, thank you so much for your time today. I really appreciate it.
Thank you.
Kaval Sheikh is a science reporter for the New York Times. She joins us by Skype to talk about a robot named TerraSentia that is being used to gather information and create a portrait for farmers testing the technology. More Tech Tuesdays coming up on All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to Tech Tuesday on All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. The Federal Trade Commission looked on but rarely took action as big tech companies gobbled up small competitors over a 10-year period ending last year. Now the FTC has taken the unusual step of ordering Amazon, Apple, Facebook, Alphabet, and Microsoft to turn over merger information from that period. It's not all mergers, just the ones valued under $90 million or those small enough to get under the mandatory reporting requirement. Wired reporter Gilad Edelman has been covering the issue. Welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me.
What triggered this?
Well, I don't know what the immediate trigger was, but the announcement of this inquiry is the latest in a line of actions might be too strong a word, but steps that we're seeing taken by both the state and federal government. Over the last several years, there's been an uptick in interest in antitrust law generally, and as it applies to big tech specifically.
There's a way that you put it in your your story that sort of struck me. You said, let's see if I can find it. You said, you know, that it, you described it as the key subplot in the tale of big tech, how they achieve dominance by buying up the rest.
Right. I think that one thing that's flown under the radar, but people are becoming a lot more aware of now, is that the most dominant companies have gotten to where they are not just by innovating or selling the best product or network effects, but just by buying the competition. So, you know, famous examples, Google owns YouTube, Facebook owns Instagram, and YouTube and Instagram are two of the biggest, most profitable social media networks that exist. And for every Instagram or YouTube acquisition, there are hundreds of smaller ones of companies that nobody's ever heard of. And these acquisitions can be helpful to the company, to the bigger company, in a variety of ways. You know, sometimes it's just, you know, bringing in the, in the case of Facebook and Instagram, the most obvious thing is just the money that Instagram would be bringing in is now going to Facebook's bottom line. Mm-hmm. One area of concern that is sort of implicated in this FTC announcement is the so-called killer acquisition, which is when a company buys a smaller one seemingly just to put it out of business. And, you know, these sort of almost by definition are lower profile because they usually involve companies that aren't big enough to really be on the public's radar, but mm-hmm. the larger company has identified as a growing rival.
Can you give me an example?
In The Wire, when Stringer tries to take over Marlo Stanfield's drug dealing operation, but maybe one from the tech sector. Mm-hmm. Google, several years. a couple examples that I mentioned in my article that people have accused of, or, you know, people have categorized killer acquisitions because I can't get inside the heads of the executives who made these deals. But Google some years ago bought the photo sharing site Picasa, uh-huh. Which you probably haven't heard of. Maybe, you know,
I vaguely remember it. Yeah. Like,
yeah. And they phased it out of existence. And, you know, they have their own product, Google Photos. And so a lot of people look at an acquisition like that as an example where the point is more just to take out this potential threat to the business.
There's a sense, as an outsider observing the tech industry and in the tech world as it exists today, that a lot of startups want to be bought, that they're not opposed to this.
Yeah, you know, I don't have my finger on the pulse of the startup community in San Francisco as much as some of my colleagues. I'm based here in D.C. Mm-hmm. and have my eye largely on how these issues intersect with government. Mm-hmm. However, what I can tell you is that, you know, anecdotally, there are a lot of companies that end up selling because they don't really see any other choice. I think most, for many entrepreneurs, the prospect of a big payday by selling your company to a bigger firm like Facebook, Google, or Amazon is pretty cool. But I think for very many, and perhaps most, that's not really the dream that got them out of bed every morning. A lot of entrepreneurs really want to build something big, and I think a lot chafe at the reality that it seems like you're either going to get killed by the bigger competition, or if you're lucky, you know, get bought out by them.
I'm kind of stunned at the mandatory reporting requirement only is for 90 million or over in an acquisition. I must be very simple, but wow. I mean, that kind of leaves the field wide open as it is, doesn't it?
Well, this gets somewhat into the weeds of antitrust law. Mm-hmm. We're talking about the pre-merger notification program,
right,
which is something established by federal law in the 70s, which just says that for acquisitions of a certain size, and it has to do with the buying company has to be a certain size, and then the value of the company that they are purchasing has to be a certain size. And that number was pegged last year at about $90 million for the smaller company. And the, what this does is it makes these makes the companies involved in these mergers notify the FTC and the DOJ, which are the two federal antitrust enforcing authorities. Mm-hmm. It does, you know, it does allow hundreds, you know, it has allowed hundreds of tech acquisitions to go through without drawing antitrust attention. But having said that, it's, you know, it's not like the antitrust regulators came down really hard on the big deals. You know, Google bought DoubleClick,
right,
and AdMob, and YouTube, and Facebook bought Instagram, so, and WhatsApp. So it's not like the government would have been blocking all these smaller deals because they were allowing the larger ones.
So what can regulators do at this point? These acquisitions have gone forward, in some cases, years and years ago now. What, in a world where 6 weeks is a long time in the tech industry, it feels like, what can they do?
Yeah, that's a good question. I mean, so first of all, with this FTC announcement, it got a lot of attention because it showed that the agency is suddenly paying attention to a broader set of issues that relate to competition.
Mm-hmm.
But it's not, it's likely to take a couple years, and there's really no guarantee that any action will come out of it. What, you know, in theory, what can they do? They can do quite a bit. The FTC in particular has really broad statutory powers. Although those powers are curtailed somewhat by federal judges, who in many cases will have the final say. But in theory, if the FTC goes back and finds that some deal that was made is clearly anti-competitive, even if it was 8 years ago, they can go in and make and reverse the deal.
They asked for information from the companies. What does that mean? What are they looking for?
It seems like they're casting a really wide net.
Hmm.
And this falls under this is one way in which the FTC has really quite a bit of power. They can do these broad industry-wide investigations without necessarily making any kind of case that they think the law has been broken. They have a broad mandate just to learn about an industry. So that's what's happening. That's the authority that they're using here, and they're asking for. So first, they're just asking for all the financial documents that the companies would have had to turn over if they were subject to the pre-merger reporting. So if these were bigger deals, there's just some basic stuff that they always have to report. But then they're asking for other stuff like corporate acquisition strategies, documentation on that. If there are non-compete covenants that were part of the deal, post-acquisition product development and pricing, and then one more that seemed kind of interesting was how acquired data has been treated, because. And those last two things are interesting. So post-acquisition stuff, behavior, basically, you know, the idea with merger reviews is, okay, these two companies are going to combine.
Uh-huh.
Is that going to be a bad deal for the consumer in some way down the road,
mm-hmm.
or for smaller competitors? And they can make, you know, companies often make promises. No, it's going to be fine. We're not going to raise prices. We're not going to cut back offerings. And by asking for information about product development and pricing after the mergers, the FTC is going to find out, well, what actually happened here? Did this actually, you know, did this company, did Google buy, not to pick on Google too much, but did Google buy Picasa and then stop investing as much in their, you know, in innovation in photo sharing? And then on the data front, I think that's pretty interesting because when a company buys another company, you know, when a company bought a company in the 70s, maybe they were buying their factories and they were taking over their employees and their supply chain. But in 2020, mm-hmm. especially with these tech companies, you're also buying the data that the other firm has been collecting. And that we've done a pretty bad job at putting a dollar amount on that data. It's data that, you know, is coming from you and it's coming from me and all kinds of other sources. And so it does seem noteworthy that the government is now realizing that the data that a smaller company has may be part of the reason for the acquisition and might factor into the impact that a merger has on competition in the sector.
You open your article with the Facebook acquisition of WhatsApp for $22 billion in 2014. Was that the case there? Or was it more access to the European market?
WhatsApp, on the surface, the most obvious reason for that was WhatsApp just was killing Facebook in usage, killing Facebook Messenger in usage outside the United States.
Mm-hmm.
So it just was a big growing rival for social networking. But you're right that Facebook didn't just buy WhatsApp and, add that to its portfolio. It then gets access to all the insights you can get from the users. And in fact, so the FTC did look at that deal, and Facebook promised, we will not integrate WhatsApp with our other messaging services, because mm-hmm. people were kind of alarmed at that, because part of the appeal of WhatsApp was that it's encrypted. And so if you're a user, you like having the options.
Right.
Like, I could use Facebook Messenger, I could use Signal, I could use WhatsApp, and I like WhatsApp because it's more secure than Facebook, whatever. And so Facebook promised they wouldn't do that, and then a couple of years later they reneged on that and they actually got fined. But you can see the value for a company like Facebook of integrating those different messaging platforms, because then they can be sucking up a lot more data.
So how have the companies responded? Amazon, Apple, Facebook, Alphabet, obviously Google's parent company, and Microsoft. Are they just figuring this is just business as usual and they're just going to plod away with it and wear them down, or what?
It's too early to know for sure. You know, I reached out to the companies for comment. Most of them declined to comment or just didn't answer. Microsoft gave a kind of blanket, we're happy to work with the government. And, you know, experts I talked to said that they can't really challenge this. I mean, clearly the FTC has this legal authority, but they could certainly make it hard. They can slow walk it. They can, their lawyers can contest the relevance of certain questions. So it remains to be seen whether, they'll just drag their heels a little bit, or they'll do kind of all out resistance. But either way, this is likely to take some time.
You know, it is kind of startling in your reporting. I saw that Apple was buying a company every 2 to 3 weeks last year. It's like, it's kind of amazing what they're able to do now.
Yeah, and it's an important way that the biggest companies have gotten so big and gotten so dominant. And for years, the tech companies, in addition to coming up with innovative products or solving problems that people had, they also had the good fortune, particularly the more recent ones, Facebook and Google and Amazon, they had the good fortune of coming up at a time when antitrust enforcement was pretty lax. Antitrust is the body of law that basically governs competition. And beginning in the late 1970s, the government's position basically became, well, if it's not going to lead to higher prices, it's probably fine.
Huh.
And so what that meant, if you think about a company like Facebook, what do they charge for Facebook? $0, right? Amazon, super low prices. Google is free. YouTube is free. So if you look at them from through that lens, you think, okay, there's no problem here. I mean, they're offering stuff for free. So
But nothing's free.
Not getting hurt. Nothing's right. That's yeah. Nothing is free, especially when and that's why the fact that the FTC is looking at the use of data is interesting, because if you put a value on data, then you start to realize that there may be a cost involved that we haven't been talking about.
That's the game changer. FTC Chair Joseph Simons said that you wrote that he suggested that the main priority is simply figuring out whether smaller transactions should be subject to reporting requirements moving forward. Is there any sense that they're going to change the regulations?
I think it's too soon to say.
Well, Gilad Edelman, thank you for your time today. I appreciate it.
Thanks for having me.
Gilad Edelman is a reporter for Wired Magazine. Wrote about how the FTC is going to revisit a bunch of deals over the course of 10 years, ending in 2019, with the biggest tech companies there are. You name them. They're in that list of five. We have more Tech Tuesday coming up on All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to Tech Tuesday on All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. For those who like foldable phones, February has been a good month for rollouts. First, Motorola launched its new Razr phone. Now Samsung has unveiled its Galaxy Z Flip. They have a lot in common, but there are important differences, too. Here to talk more about it, Russell Holley, contributing editor at Android Central. Welcome back, Russell.
Thank you.
So, the Flips are here. What do you make of them?
That's right. So we had our first folding phone was really kind of a fold phone that expanded into a tablet that Samsung made earlier this year. And it had some problems. There were some screen issues. It got delayed for a little while. Samsung came back with a phone that flips vertically, kind of like the flip phones of old, and has called it, you know, the Galaxy Z Flip. And has moved away from the plastic display that allowed it to kind of bend and fold in exchange for what it's calling an ultra-thin glass, which is a combination glass technology that allows for a certain degree of flexibility. It's not nearly the same level of flexibility as plastic, but it gives that same kind of feeling. Mm-hmm. The hazard to this, however, is it is, as the name suggests, incredibly thin. And in several of the initial tests to see what that meant, it was actually pretty easy to puncture straight through that ultra thin glass, by dropping the phone or by accidentally having the phone in the same pocket as your keys, or something similar to that. So the phone is, it is certainly not as scratch prone as some of the plastic displays, but it is in fact quite fragile. And can be a problem, especially when you consider this is a phone that you're going to be spending $1,500 on.
Yeah. Why the demand for foldable phones?
This is actually a really fascinating question, because the other way that this question gets asked is who is actually asking for this phone? Because it doesn't seem like, outside of kind of techie nerdy people, that the desire for a phone that folds in half is particularly high. Mm-hmm. And the answer to this is a return to kind of portability and pocketability. One of the really fascinating things about these phones is that you can put them in pockets again. Because as I'm sure you are aware, Anne, not every set of pockets that you own can hold your phone.
That's for sure.
We're now talking about phones that are, technologically the same as a recent iPhone or a recent Samsung Galaxy phone that'll actually fit in a large coin pocket in most men's pants, which means that it will fit in just about everyone's pockets. And that is a return to form that seemed kind of gone in a world where, Apple was releasing phones that have, 5.5 to 6 inch screens as kind of the default. There have always been people who have said, man, I wish that I could have a smaller phone again. There are still people who upgrade from older iPhones to the iPhone from 3 or 4 years ago just because it is that kind of smaller rectangle, and Apple still sells them specifically for those people. So the question that folding itself is not really the feature. It's that kind of portability and pocketability that I think there are still some people who really miss as a feature.
Right. Having all of that without giving up the screen, obviously.
Exactly.
That's the problem, is folding the screen. Yeah. Right.
So you've got these two phones now that do this, one made by Samsung and one made by Motorola. Unfortunately, the one made by Motorola, while it plays really heavy into nostalgia by pulling on the Razer brand, everyone who had a Razer back in the day remembers loving that phone.
Mm-hmm.
And so having this kind of brand to lean on was something that Motorola was really kind of hoping would boost sales. Unfortunately, the phone is just not very good. The battery life is not really something to write home about. The cameras are not very good. The screen itself is that kind of plasticky screen, which means it's prone to scratches and is not likely to last super long through day-to-day use, even with a screen protector. And it's important to keep in mind that screen protectors are difficult on a phone that is already made of something that is the same material as the screen protector. So kind of adding layers there makes it so that it doesn't fold quite as well. If there's a lot of challenges associated with this. And really what it comes down to is these first generation of folding phones are really great kind of tech concepts. They're really great for people who really kind of want to be on the bleeding edge. These are not either one of them phones that I would recommend to most people yet.
Okay.
Especially because of the price tag associated
right.
with them.
Right, exactly. $1,500. Wow. FTC wants to reexamine Google's acquisition of Waze from 2013. Now, we just got done talking about with a Wired reporter how FTC is revisiting hundreds of deals by big tech. Is that part of this, or is this separate?
Yes, this sweep is part of it, but it's probably one of the most significant of the ones that FCC has announced that it's looking into, because it is the clearest case for something that we know now in the future had a pretty significant impact on the way that we view phone maps. Google Maps is still kind of the dominant champion when it comes to a GPS service on your phone. If you want an accurate service, the thing that gets recommended is Google Maps. Its traffic data is unmatched. It's time to location is almost always perfectly accurate. The updates that it gets to construction and things like that are always, kind of well ahead of a lot of the competition. Google Maps has been a dominant force for quite a while now, and that has at least something to do with the acquisition of Waze. Waze gave it a lot of real-time tracking information and access to user-reported information, like where police checkpoints were set up, for example, and traffic, things. These are all things that have now been integrated into Google Maps, and it makes Google Maps significantly more effective. So it's kind of an interesting situation that Google is in. Buying Waze seemed like a really good idea at the time, but now that we've seen where things are 7 years later, a reasonable argument can be made for buying Waze was a big part of why Google is now dominating this industry, and why when there really isn't space for a competitor to come out. Apple tried and really just was unsuccessful for quite some time to release a mapping system that was competing with Google. It just didn't have access to the same level of data. And if a company as large as Apple can't be successful releasing a competing product, it really makes a case for antitrust regulation. So, if the FTC is going to start, kind of looking back in time and seeing where these problematic things started, it's not immediately clear what the next step is, because, the regulation was approved, the purchase was approved 7 years ago.
Right. It didn't fall under that $90 million limit. I mean, it was a billion. What was it, a billion
right.
and a half or something? 1.1 right. billion.
A tremendous
yeah.
amount of money at the time. And so we now know, 7 years later, that it really did have a significant impact on the landscape. So I'm really curious to see in their evaluation, even if the FTC determines that this was kind of an antitrust situation, it's been 7 years and Google's had access to this data for so long and now has their own tools for recreating this data. Even if Google were forced to separate Waze from Google Maps, I don't see it being something that significantly alters the state of the market right now.
Well, all right. So I use Google Maps, and my spouse uses Waze, they still operate separately as far as the user experience is concerned, right?
That's correct. You know, Google Maps never really leaned into the ability for a person to go in and push buttons to say, yes, there's a traffic thing here. Mm-hmm. It's always been kind of automated. And occasionally Google Maps will say, hey, there's a slowdown here. Can you give me some more information about why that is? But Waze has always been significantly more proactive. And that's always been something that people have appreciated. So it depends significantly on how much information needs to be separated and what decision the FCC makes for what that dividing line has to look like.
Or is this an exercise in regulation going forward and not anything that they may, since they already approved it, how can they?
It would be really interesting to see this inform future decisions. You know,
yeah.
now that they have seen this, you know, 7 years in the future, you know, the FCC could stand up and say, you know, okay, based on this information, we're actually going to tighten the criteria needed in order for mergers like this to be approved in the future. That doesn't really impact Google in any significant way because Google is already now in charge of the largest mapping platform on the planet, mm-hmm. but it does help inform antitrust regulation moving forward.
You know, the idea that the FTC is only starting to integrate the issue of data acquisition into these equations now kind of smacks of naivete. I mean, even I understand about the data acquisition and why anybody gives me anything for free, Google or whoever it is, you know, all the stuff that Apple packs into its phones, all the apps and stuff. I mean, what do you make of that suddenly waking up and smelling the coffee thing that's going on at the FTC?
Honestly, I think, you know, from a regulatory standpoint as a whole, mm-hmm. this is all 5 to 10 years too late. You know, we're looking at, you know, at the same time that we're seeing privacy concerns on an almost monthly basis when one company or another leaks a certain amount of information for people. This is all you know, stuff that we should have been proactive on a long time ago and considered something. There's a conversation that happens, you know, around the internet called a digital bill of rights.
Yeah.
You know, where it's all about protecting, you know, having regulation that protects your information. And the counter argument that we see to that right now is so worrisome because the counter argument to a digital bill of rights is that it's too late, that this information already exists.
Yeah, cows out of the barn,
profiles.
Right.
And so I would hate to see the same argument be deployed in the FTC for data regulation because I don't believe that it's too late. I think that, okay. You know, once you agree that it's too late, you completely ignore the fact that there are children who use the internet every day.
Mm-hmm.
And even if it's too late for one generation, that does not mean that it has to be too late for future generations.
And what about the idea of value creating or establishing a value point for data? And that kind of a thing going forward. They weren't really considering that when they were looking at these kinds of mergers between Waze and Google.
I feel like the way that we're having this conversation right now is slightly disingenuous. Facebook released figures not all that long ago where it said that the value of data for an individual person is on average something like 32 cents. And that is probably true of the average person that uses Facebook in that if you take the people who use Facebook once a month and average it with the people who use Facebook every 60 seconds,
mm-hmm.
you probably come with something like 32 cents. But I don't feel like I feel like presenting the information that way really obfuscates how much value there is to people who are constantly using the internet, who live on the internet, who share every single thing
uh-huh.
that comes to their mind to Facebook or Twitter. And so we need to be having this conversation in a more honest fashion in order to better get a feel for just how valuable this information is.
Hmm. Well, it's an ongoing conversation, I'm sure. We'll be looking forward to that. Microsoft removed a security update. It was a recent security update for Windows 10. It's caused issues on some PCs. What are we talking about here?
Yeah, so that, you know, Microsoft released regular software updates,
uh-huh.
And the software updates
painfully
for a lot
aware.
Of Windows
yeah.
PCs. That's right. These software updates often update when you are most doing in the middle of doing something you're most interested in doing,
mm-hmm.
and in some cases will kind of update in the background so that you're not aware. But the most recent update actually has an unforeseen side effect in that it actually disables or makes ineffective the button in Windows 10 that allows you to reset your PC. So if you go in and you need to, kind of factory reset your system, or you need to, kind of wipe away your data in order to give it something else, Windows 10 has a very, user-friendly button that allows it to happen automatically. But with this most recent security update, it actually makes it so that it doesn't work. It addresses an issue inside of what's called a UEFI boot manager to make, this work. The update itself is really important because there's a vulnerability inside of this that could be exploited to extract personal data from someone's computer. But in trying to repair that issue, it disabled this really useful feature for wiping away your data. So the Microsoft's update right now, you can actually go to your update history and kind of, kind of revert an update where you can kind of uninstall the update. And that's what Microsoft is recommending people do right now if you need that reset your PC function. So that you can do this while Microsoft works on a fix that addresses both of these things.
Can normal mortals do this very easily?
Yes, there's a very quick set of instructions for going through and resetting the update. Microsoft has instructions posted online. My colleagues at Windows Central have a simple guide for doing so. It's 4 or 5 steps in order to go through and make sure that it works. And the bottom line here is, this is only something that you need to be actively worried about if you are planning to reset your PC in the next couple of weeks, maybe to sell to someone or because you need to address a problem and you want to, kind of reset from scratch. If you are not immediately concerned about that being a problem, Microsoft will be releasing another update within the next week or two that will address this.
Okay.
But it's something that more people should be aware of.
So if you uninstall this, does that mean you uninstall everything that the update included?
Yes. The idea here is to go back to the previous state from last week, which does, expose this current vulnerability to your computer. But it's a vulnerability that is only most effective when someone has physical access to your computer. So that is less of a concern for a lot of individuals who, don't often hand their laptop off to other people. But it is something to be aware of, is that in uninstalling this, you are kind of reverting a pretty significant security update. So it's probably not something that everyone needs to go out right this second and do.
But be aware.
It's an important thing to be aware of, is something happening with Windows 10 machines right now.
Speaking of resetting and getting rid of technology, what do you do with all of your old computers and all of your stuff, your phones and things? What do you do with them?
So my old phones that are my personal devices, I factory reset them and they get donated to Cell Phones for Soldiers.
Okay.
But a lot of times the hardware that I'm working with is actually on loan from the company that created it. So yep. Samsung will send me a device and it'll get sent back after the review period is expired. But for my personal devices, if it's something that an immediate friend or family member can make use of, then that's great. But if not, then it'll get donated to an appropriate charity.
Okay. And what do you think about any strong feelings about Sonic the Hedgehog movie?
The strongest feeling that I have about Sonic the Hedgehog is that it looks much better after the update. But unfortunately, that update put a lot of people out of work because the studio responsible for that movie followed very clear instructions from the producers and created the first version of that movie in order to make it look the way that they were told to look. And then there was a lot of backlash from community who was excited about Sonic, which is understandable because it looked awful.
Yeah.
But then they refreshed it to look more like the character that we're familiar with from the games. And in doing so, combined with the work done on the Lion King movie, bankrupted the company. And so a lot of very talented visual editors who were likely the least expensive bid on producing the graphics for these movies were then out of a job, which is not something that I think consumers should feel personally responsible for. I think it's a victory that they were able to use their voice in order to get something changed in this space so that it didn't just look so bad. But it is deeply unfortunate that process bankrupted a significant company and put 60 or 70 people out of work in the process. I kind of don't want to watch the movie because I know what it meant for a bunch of people to lose their job, but also I was a huge Sonic the Hedgehog fan back then, so it's tough.
Oh, gosh, the moral conundrum. But Russell Holley, thank you for sharing that. Thanks, as always, for all your help today.
Thank you for having me.
Russell Holley, contributing editor, Android Central. That's it for Tech Tuesday today. Thanks for listening. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.